Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Kimberly Bonvasuto, content editor at McKnight's Senior Living, one of the most trusted sources of news, insight, and analysis for leaders across senior housing. Kimberly spends her days at the center of the conversation, shaping senior living. Her work helps communities make sense of what matters most and what's coming next. Kimberly, welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Thanks, Derek.
So McKnight's Senior Living is one of the industry's most respected publications. When you look at senior living today, what storylines feel most important for our industry?
Well, we appreciate the compliment. McKnight's Senior Living actually won a Neal Award this year in the
That's
Best
great.
Range of Work category. And you and those listening might not be familiar with that award, but in the business-to-business media world, it's considered the equivalent of a Pulitzer Prize. So we're
That's
very
fantastic.
Proud of that accomplishment. And we take seriously our role of keeping providers informed and helping them make a difference in their work. So as far as important storylines, I'd say the silver wave is finally here. The industry needs to find a way to address the discrepancy between supply and demand. There's just not enough supply right now. And according to Nick Mapp, senior living development rates are meeting only 25% of the pace necessary to sustain demand. Inventory issues are expected to worsen, with data indicating a need for 806,000 additional senior living units by 2030. So prospective and near future residents, they also want something different than current and previous residents. Another thing we're looking at, assisted living is becoming more of a healthcare setting. They're delving into value-based care, participating in the CMS Guide program, the Dementia Care Management Pilot Program. The need for workers is an ongoing issue, but it's made even greater by the wave. Argentum has reported that 3 million jobs in senior living would need to be filled in the country by 2040. And that's only part of the 20 million overall jobs that are going to be needed in the long-term care sector overall. The increasing use of technology and AI and how that will change the delivery of care and services is another hot topic. It could help with some of the staffing needed. Leading age president and CEO Katie Smith Sloan said during the association's annual conference this year that tech seemed to be top of mind, most interested among members, surpassing staffing for the first time based on session attendance. So that's what we're seeing.
Sure. Interesting. And you're right. AI is permeating every conversation, every conference, and not just in our field of aging services, but, in fields across the country. But, it really is interesting. And I know we've had some conversations recently with folks either on this podcast or elsewhere about AI and robotics and technology helping the workforce. And I know Bob Kramer, who was on a few episodes ago, was talking about things like exoskeletons and ways that they're using it in Asia, or using that sort of technology to help older adults help other older adults, who can't necessarily physically lift and do those sorts of things, but giving that opportunity.
Right.
So it's going to be a very different world in the coming years.
It will.
So what's a trend that you think the senior living industry is overreacting to, and maybe a trend that's not getting enough attention?
So overreacting, going back to AI, it's a hot topic right now, but providers need to be careful that the tech they adopt will solve the issues they're facing.
Mm-hmm.
So tech has an important role to play in helping operators meet challenges, but they need to be careful and not tempted by that latest, that shiny object, and be sure to do due diligence. Not paying enough attention, maybe solo agers. As the oldest baby boomers age into senior living, the number of childless older adults is rising dramatically. And solo agers aren't just childless older adults. They might not have a spouse or a partner. They might have children or family who live far away, or they're estranged from their family for various reasons. It's not exactly a new issue, but it'll be a growing one as more prospects are people who have fewer children or are childless. And another, maybe not paying enough attention, middle market. Everyone knows about it, but addressing it's a challenge. But if providers don't address it, they're leaving a big opportunity and money on the table.
Mm-hmm. And a need. You know, so much of the field is not-for-profit or nonprofit mission-based.
Right.
And, you know, to be able to serve that middle market is so critical. And you know, you raise a really good point with the solo agers. We've had Dr. Sarah Zef Geber on.
Right.
The podcast, and I know she's really bringing that to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And I loved how you had highlighted, because my assumption when I first heard the term was it was individuals, you know, who were, you know, not partnered or didn't have, you know, kids or something. But you're right; it's people who are just needing to age without that support network. And what can they do to provide that? So I think those are all, you know, amazing. Trends, I guess, that you identified. So now we've heard about the changing face of the media in every facet of media. Newspapers are shrinking in circulation. Magazines are moving online, and digital is an increasing line item in marketing budgets. What are some of the more dramatic changes you've seen in the media across your career?
Well, social media has certainly had a major impact on journalism and media, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
What I find surprising is how quickly people will believe whatever they read online if it fits into their belief system. In that same vein, the rise of AI is also impacting journalism. Again, both in good and bad ways. Dupes, AI-created images and videos, they're getting more difficult to detect as the technology advances. So a healthy dose of skepticism is critical these days. But I think the bigger problem is the dramatic drop in trust and negative attention to mainstream media, which, you know, in my profession, I find it shocking and concerning. Well, I think it's healthy for the media to have some pushback to ensure fair and accurate coverage. Demonizing those who work day in and day out to bring the important news of the day to the masses, it's really reprehensible.
I agree fully. And, you know, not to go down a rabbit hole or get too political, but not knowing who you can trust, where you can go for information, and not trusting actual facts, I think is really alarming. And then you couple that with AI, where suddenly you don't know it, you know, even if you have news sources you can trust, all of a sudden you don't know what you can trust anymore because it looks so real. And, you know, it really is jarring as a consumer, but also, you know, as someone who interacts with a lot of media, just in our roles. So I can only imagine from your seat how frustrating that is, you know, to make sure that you're not losing credibility through no fault of your own, but because of just the way of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So how much of your coverage comes from ideas pitched to you versus ideas you identify yourself?
I would actually say it's pretty equal. A good part of my morning every day is spent reading through email pitches and, you know, just combing through websites for today's news and going to associations. So it's kind of a toss-up.
Hmm. Interesting. So what's the biggest difference between a pitch that gets opened, or that you read and go, that's interesting, or one that simply gets ignored? And I don't want to say ignored, but that you decide not to pursue.
So our writers, we have to write 3 stories a day, 5 days a week. So I don't have time to read through a long, drawn out pitch before I get to what it is you're actually pitching. Get to the point right away. I said, you know, I actually prefer if someone just sends me a quick email with a couple sentences and then they bullet point, you know, the top things that they're trying to sell me. And sometimes I get pitches for one thing, but I end up using something else in the pitch to take the story in a completely different direction. One of them was, I think it was about hiring a chef or something like that. And while I didn't much care about that angle, I was interested in how the community revamped its entire dining program and was doing something that I had never heard of before.
Hmm.
Now, that said, I get emails every single day from communities telling me that they have a unique dining program. You know, so I mean, unless a lot of times it's something that it's unique to them, but it's being done throughout the industry. And, you know, we may have already covered it. So it just depends.
Sure. And it is interesting how, we all like to think we're unique, right? And right. You know, in our personal lives and professional lives. But you're right. There's so much that might be unique in a particular marketplace, but it isn't necessarily newsworthy, probably on a national scale. So that is interesting. So, wow, 3 stories a day.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. So are you working on multiple stories at a time? Like, so for example, if you're writing that story, will you start it and then finish it 5 days from now? Or do you?
Oh no, it's the same day.
In the same day. Okay.
Same day. Yeah. A lot of times you're working on one and then you're answering an email because you sent questions out for another one and you're arranging an interview on a third story. So it's just constant motion.
Sure. That is interesting. And I think that's an important lesson. And, you know, we've certainly known it, but you're underscoring the fact that if any of the folks out there listening want to be a resource, and I mean, you know, face it, everybody wants to be considered an expert and quoted in articles and such. The key is get back to you right away because you're not going to wait for anything.
Right.
Because you can't. So interesting. And I know, and we've appreciated that you've joined a lot of our weekly roundtables and written a number of stories. That makes perfect sense now when you're needing to have that velocity of of content that you're putting out.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some
great topics.
Thank you. Really appreciate that. What are some details you wish more communities and PR teams included up front to make a story stronger and easier to cover? I know you mentioned few bullets get to the point, but anything else?
One of my biggest pet peeves, I think my colleagues would share this, is if you're going to send me something like a report or a survey or something under embargo, have someone available to talk about it immediately. Don't tell me that you'll get back to me in a week or two and then ask me to give you dates for an interview, because I'm either just going to run with whatever it is that you sent me, or I'm going to move on. You know, sure. If you're not ready, don't send it.
Great point. And for those who might be listening and aren't familiar with the term embargo, do you mind describing what that means?
An embargo is someone will send us some information, like a report or a survey, and they'll say it's not for public release until tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. or it's not for release until a week from today. And then they give you the option of setting up interviews. Now, that's fine if you are giving me some time to, you know, set up interviews. But if you're sending me something and saying that it's, you know, this is good to go and we're releasing this right now, and then I contact you and you say, yeah, well, we don't have anybody available to talk about that for another week, you know, forget it.
Sure. Yep. That makes perfect sense. I can only imagine, you know, again, when you're trying to move as swiftly as you need to, that gets frustrating. So a lot of times media coverage is built on trust and relationships. How can providers build real long-term relationships with reporters and editors without only showing up when they have good news to promote?
I would say be responsive. I mean, virtually everyone is going to have an incident that draws negative attention. And if something happens that gains national attention, you've probably got local reporters as well as national organizations beating down your door. It's okay to say that you can't comment, especially on like pending litigation. Even better, you can talk about initiating an internal investigation regarding an event. You know, I would say create a statement that you can share widely. You know, we're all just looking for, you know, that little something. Sure. So to say that we talked to someone. I've also worked with PR firms that will call me on background and they'll give me more insight into what's going on. It's not for me to print or, you know, quote them on, but most times I do end up getting the official no comment from them. But now I know I can trust them to give me the background so I can determine whether or not this is something truly worth pursuing, or if it's just a minor infraction that got blown up.
Sure. No, that makes sense. Now, in a lot of our work for our clients, we'll build out an online media center that might have various assets, you know, whether it's B-roll footage. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, you do some video work, but it could be still images, it could be logos, it could be the press release. Is that something that's helpful, or what tools do you find helpful that can provide the assets and materials and whatnot to make your job easier and more efficient?
If you just have a little statement about what your organization is, if it's a provider or an operator, where do you operate? How many communities do you have? If it applies, how many residents do you have? How many employees do you have? You know, pictures of the community we would probably use if it's on a media page. But again, you can even just throw up a quick statement on a website when something happens, and, you know, anybody would be able to find it. So it's just something quick.
Yep. Well, that's good advice. Thank you. Thank you for that. Cause you know, we have enough experience with media where we know we need to make it easy and, accessible, and such. And we also know, and I guess this is something too, everybody in the seat of the client or the agency wants to control the message. Mm-hmm. And, I know from my experience, folks in your seat are trying to tell an accurate,
correct,
fair, balanced story. So I guess where does that, intersection meet, or what has your experience been? I'm sure you've had some people who are really trying to, it might be too strong a term, but lean on you to write a story, and you have to remain somewhat agnostic. Talk a little about that, if you would, please.
I have, there's one particular man, he emails me every Saturday. He's emailed me every Saturday for about 2 months now. It's a sad story. His mother was in a facility. She wound up dying. It sounds like there's a lot of family dynamics going on. He is upset at what happened. He wants us to investigate. That's not really something we do, but a lot of times we'll take those calls, we'll take those emails, and it's just someone, they want to complain to someone. They want someone to listen. We do that a lot. We're not a consumer publication. We don't write for, families and older adults. We write for the operators and the providers. So, but people still find us because of the topics that we write about. So a lot of times we're just listening, and we tell that, most times we'll direct them, have you tried the ombudsman? You know, have you tried working with the community? You know, things like that.
Sure.
So it just depends on the situation. If there's a lawsuit that's been filed and there's something that we can look at, and they're, you know how lawsuits work and how the language that's in there. So we're just looking for the provider on the other side. A lot of times they can't comment because they're in pending litigation, but it's okay to say that. It's okay to say that, you've reviewed processes and you're, working to prevent whatever happened from happening again, that kind of thing.
Sure. Interesting. So this is a question that every roundtable guest gets. What are you looking forward to as you age?
Honestly, not having a schedule.
I bet three articles a day.
My father-in-law always said, you get used to getting up early in the morning when you don't have to do it every day. And I like to tell him, you're wrong.
That's great. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier in our conversation that staff recruitment and retention have been major issues in senior living for a while. What workforce stories are you hearing consistently from community leaders?
Well, during and immediately after the pandemic, it was all about bonuses and pay bumps and benefits. And now it's mostly about culture. And there's something to be said for both. You know, everyone wants to get paid more. But if you have a culture that takes your voice into consideration and works with you during difficult times, that says a lot. And I recently sat in on a panel discussion about alternative senior living models, including the citizenship model community. Jill Vitale Awesome of Christian Living Communities, she described the model as something that turns to the people who live and work in senior living communities for the answers. So rather than making decisions from the top down. And I like the way she phrased it. She views herself more as a mayor than a manager. Hmm. She sees her job as providing infrastructure and building a social fabric that brings out the best in the community. And staff and residents love it. You know, they feel seen and heard, and the process has allowed the development of a real community.
That's great. And in a lot of the communities I've been in, I would agree that I think the ones with the best culture are those that have mechanisms for involvement and for voice. You know, because a lot of folks, you know, the people who live in communities may have had, you know, storied careers in leadership and contributing in various aspects of society. And then suddenly they're expected to just sit back and take orders or just, you know,
right,
let the community decide what's going to happen. And you know, there's still so much more to give. And that's wonderful for those communities that do, you know, do that. So I think that's, you know, a really interesting way to do it. And, you know, when you're talking about workforce during the pandemic, I remember, and even coming out of it, I've talked to people who have said, you know, the frontline team members, they could go to McDonald's or Taco Bell, right, or wherever and make another dollar or two an hour, which is not insignificant, but they're not getting, it's not feeding their soul the same way, right, that, you know, working in a certainly not-for-profit senior living community does. So, you know, there are trade-offs, but you need to be providing the kind of those soft benefits as well, you know, in addition to the monetary and real benefits. So, but interesting. So where do you see the most innovation and improvement right now? Is it recruitment, retention, training, or something else as it relates to workforce?
I'm not sure anyone's found the silver bullet. Something that works for one community might not work for another. I think yesterday's pizza parties have given way to more formalized recognition programs, which can boost morale. And providing workers with the skills they need to properly do their jobs goes a long way with retention. I think I'm seeing the most innovation in dementia programs. Most communities have adopted a person-centered approach, including, you know, incorporating Montessori principles. These approaches, they not only provide softer care for those living with dementia, but they also create a more empathetic and prepared staff, which leads to fewer behavioral issues with residents and improved retention rates with staff. And then senior living is also evolving into different models. Active adult is really taking off, and some are starting to pay attention to the needs of the rising middle market. Assisted living is also moving to more of a healthcare model, whether the sector wants to admit it or not. They're incorporating wellness, aligning with others to offer value-based care. But hospitality isn't going anywhere, you know, growing through luxury senior living, especially in urban areas like Manhattan, where Maple Woods Inspire community opened.
Yeah, that's, you know, it is interesting to see how that's going and where it's going. And that's interesting the way you put, you know, pizza parties of the past are you know, morphing into, you know, other more tangible sorts of things. And I do hear that, you know, take the money that you would spend on the big pizza parties and,
right,
and those kinds of things and plow it into more meaningful ways.
Right.
And I do hear, to be fair, sometimes people say we want those opportunities to socialize and bring people together, but doing it in a purposeful and as part of a larger program is certainly important. So great points. So when you talk to high-performing operators, we could define that however we want, but high-performing operators, what do they do differently that others could replicate quickly?
One thing that comes to mind, the business is becoming more data-driven, and operators that do not want to be left behind need to be sure they're using data and using it effectively. Data can help show providers where they are doing well and where they can improve, and it can help the industry quantify its success to regulators and potential clinical partners. Ramping up data efforts can take some time, but one thing perhaps that can be replicated more quickly: high-performing operators have leaders and others who are active in the industry, always networking and trying to learn from others, whether it's through attending state and national conferences or attending webinars like the ones that McKnight's and Varsity hold. And a lot of these events are free, except for the time it takes to attend.
Sure. Great, great points. And thank you for that. So looking at the evolution of the field, we've seen a number of affiliations, mergers, and even bankruptcies. From your experience, what do you see as critical points that may be leading to these shifts?
Well, it's definitely a challenging business environment. Some transactions are due to those changing realities, with organizations just trying to get themselves into a better position for success. Some changes are coming as owners and other leaders retire, so they think it's a good time to make a move. Others are finding an affiliation or merger makes sense as a way to reduce redundant costs, standardize operations, take advantage of economies of scale. Bankruptcy can look attractive to those experiencing workforce or occupancy challenges, or they might have high debt or other expenses that are challenging to meet.
Sure. It is a difficult time from a regulatory, from a, I think you mentioned it earlier about not enough inventory, but mm-hmm. then you also have the problem where you have old inventory that would
Absolutely.
Take a significant capital improvement to be appealing. You referenced that as well, that what is that next generation looking for? And if mm-hmm. the environment doesn't meet what they want, you're not going to attract them, and they're going to have to seek other alternatives, whether that's staying at home or you know, downsizing to a condominium or some other type of community. So it is difficult to try to mm-hmm. keep up and stay ahead of that. So we've been hearing for some time about the transition of leadership and longtime C-suite leaders retiring and newer talent taking over. How do you feel about the transition, and what are some traits of the most successful transitions?
I think a lot of times change is good. I'm seeing a lot of people who've been in the industry for a very long time. They led their organizations through the pandemic, and now they're ready to pass the reins. And one trend we noticed and wrote about was the rise of co-CEOs.
I've been seeing more and more of that. Yeah, that's interesting.
I think in many ways, that's a brilliant strategy. In these cases, organizations are bringing together different mindsets, different skill sets. They're allowing each person to grow and explore their strengths. So this can only be good for senior living to have different voices contributing to the future of the industry.
Now, have you interviewed some of the co-CEOs? I'm assuming you probably have, or at least, you know, some of their organizations. But
yeah.
How is the delineation of duties typically done, or if there is a typical way of doing it? Because I would imagine they'd each have to have their own purview so that they're not tripping over each other, for example.
It really goes back to their skill sets. Some are better in the financial area. Some are better organizationally. And they kind of naturally separate that way. So if things are still being done, but I think that because you split the responsibilities, more attention to detail is going into things.
Great. Makes perfect sense. So now when we're looking at the excellence in our field, McKnight's runs some highly respected awards and recognition programs. What do the best nominations reveal about where the industry is headed?
I don't know if it's any indication of where the industry is going, but I can say that in the best nominations, people's passion for their work really comes through. That's what sets the senior living industry apart from others. So many people have a passion for what they do. And we're honored to be able to recognize and reward the quality through our awards program. And I'd be remiss not to mention that we have a couple of deadlines coming up for our Women of Distinction Awards in January. And then we also have Pinnacle Awards that are going to take place in March in New York City. And you can find out more about those on our website.
That's great. And we'll be sure to publish a link to the website. So, thank you for mentioning those. Now, you get to talk with and interact with a lot of senior living leaders up close. What are some of the most common traits you see among leaders who are truly moving the needle, who are bringing the industry forward?
In addition to the passion I mentioned, successful leaders believe in listening and open communication with their teams, and they show appreciation for their contributions. They give credit where credit's due. they have a vision for the future of their organizations, and they understand that senior living is more than simply a real estate play. The care and services within the buildings are very important to them.
It is interesting. You know, when you think about this field, it's, you know, you're right. It's not real estate. It's not hospitality. It's not care, but it's kind of at the intersection of, and perhaps there are others, but those are the three that I often think of: hospitality, care, and real estate, and such. And it is such a relational sell, and it is such a personal, you know, personal sales process that that needs to be respected, but also celebrated as we go through that. So for emerging leaders, what experiences or roles best prepare someone to lead in senior living now? What industries or parts of the senior living spectrum are best leaders coming from that you're seeing?
Well, for a long time, hospitality has been a breeding ground for future senior living leaders. There are lots of programs out there that offer senior living executive training under the umbrella of a business school's hospitality program. I've also seen leaders start working in communities as high school volunteers, working their way through the ranks. In those cases, they benefited most from mentors who gave them a chance and encouraged them along the way. And in many ways, I think those are the best leaders because they've been in the trenches and they have a true understanding of what their workforce deals with on a daily basis. Another way I've seen people enter the sector is through college internship programs. Someone in a healthcare-related program might find themselves interning or volunteering at a senior living community. And in some cases, the experience transforms their career aspirations. I know the Vision Center is working with colleges and universities to expose more students in different disciplines to the field. And that can only be positive for both higher education and for senior living.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you know Dr. Robin Stone with Leading Age. She's been on the podcast previously, and she uses a phrase, something to the effect of that senior living is an accidental career for many. And that's always resonated with me, that people don't necessarily seek it out. More and more are, hopefully, but people don't seek it out, but love it when they find it. And, I mean, there is something so rich and rewarding about the field. And I know I felt it. I didn't seek it out. A lot of my colleagues at Varsity didn't seek it out, but you know, we feel really fortunate and blessed to be working with this category. Now, I'm curious, before we end, how did you get into journalism and how did you get into senior living journalism? But tell us a little about your journey, if you would.
Let's see. My writing career, if you could call it, started in second grade, to be honest.
That's great.
We, our teacher, remember when we were learning penmanship and we had to write about an apple and it was inside of an apple shaped piece of paper. And I was the only one in the class that didn't start every sentence with "my apple." And my teacher, she complimented me on it. And that just, it set the pace. And from then on, all I wanted to do was write. And my husband, when I talk to people about how they got to where they were, I'm the person that my husband says, I came out of the womb, you know, knowing what I was going to do with my life. And to me, it's shocking that how come you didn't know that? How come it took you so long to figure out what you wanted to do? But so that's my backstory.
I love that. And the fact that you can really pinpoint it on something so specific that the light bulb went off for you. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And then senior living, I was just working at daily newspapers. I did that. I also worked in PR for 20 some years of my life. And then I had a family and I was kind of looking for something else. And it was in PR at the time when I was looking to get back into journalism. And I saw an ad from someone I know in my area who happens to be my editor now, Lois Bowers. And she had posted an opening for McKnight's. And this was, I want to say it was late 2019 when the posting actually happened. So I had met her at a Starbucks and talked to her, and I got the job offer right as the pandemic was hitting. Everything was shutting down, you know. And I told my husband I was going to quit my job of 20 years and go to work for this publication. And he just about lost his mind. He's like, "If there's a global pandemic and you're quitting your job, are you out of your mind?" And I'm like, "I know this is what I want to do, and I went for it, and it's worked out great."
That's what an amazing story. I love that, and great that you were able to work with a it sounds like a friend and colleague and such too. So
yeah,
that I'm sure made it doubly impactful.
It did.
So you know, I mean, in 6 years, I know you've amassed a lot of experience. I never would have guessed that you were in it relatively recently because of the experience that you
not
do
that
bring
long.
To them.
So I feel like I'm still in kindergarten and senior living. I'm still learning.
And, you know, it is one of those things. And when I first got into senior living, I did not initially respect the nuance and how interesting the category is. And boy, was I in for a rude awakening and you know, been peeling back the layers. I've been in it now for 16, 18 years, something like that,
okay.
But I'm still learning.
Yep.
You know, there's always something new to learn and new ways to deliver the services. Now, one thing I'm curious about, you referenced AI earlier in the conversation. I know this is something that we're integrating in different ways in our workflow, not with any final work product or anything else. How are you using AI to support you in your deadlines and your need to push out work? And, what role is that playing for you?
I'll be honest, not very much right now. Our company is starting to roll out some tools and some education and things like that. So trying to take advantage of that, it's not something that I grew up with. So it's still rather foreign to me, but I see it as something that can be helpful if used the right way.
I think that's a great point. And, you know, I do fear that too many people are going to be just leaning on AI. And, you know, the critical thinking, the direction, the insights aren't going to necessarily be there. And we're all just, AI is going to generate articles. It's going to talk to other AI articles. And we're just going to get into this, not to sound doomsday or conspiracy or whatever, but, you know, that we do need to make sure that we're critically thinking as we're using it as a tool. So I think that's
right.
Those are wise words. Well, Kimberly, this has been just a delight to have a conversation with you. I do have one last question.
Sure.
So what have you learned over your career that you wish you could have told your younger self?
I would say take more risks, be more adventurous. I'm somewhat living vicariously through my 27-year-old son right now. He didn't take the traditional college route. Instead, gaining life experiences through travel. So he spent a year on the Hawaiian Islands working and getting to know more about the people and the culture. He spent another year living and working in Australia, where my husband and I were fortunate enough to be able to visit him. And he had some rough patches. He was living in a tent near an airport at one point, but he persevered and he gained a lifetime of experiences that few of us get a chance to see. He's also traveled to Thailand, Bali, and Japan, and wow. I know I'm forgetting some places, but he has friends across the globe, which I find priceless.
And at 27, what a collection of experiences that he's had. That's great. That's great. Well, Kimberly, thank you so much. I've always enjoyed our conversations. I always appreciate you joining our weekly roundtables when you can. And now I have a little more insight as to how your days are structured and how fast paced they are. So, but thank you. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. I'm Derek Dunham, and we'll see you next time on Roundtable Talk.